I'm Alex, and welcome to the very first episode in our brand new season of The Northern Guide to Happiness. We're really happy to be back spreading more joy and happiness around the Northeast, thanks to funding from the National Lottery Community Fund and the Newcastle COVID Fund. As always, I'm here in our virtual studio with the rest of the podcast team, Kath and Chris. How are you?
Oh, Baz, yes.
Fine. Hi.
Hello, everybody.
Back. Yeah. Excited.
Trying to remember how to do this after having a month
do
off.
What? What is this?
Do what?
why am I here?
How's everyone been?
Okay. Yeah, I'm just coming out of a week off, which is always nice. It's been chilly, which, you know,
it's been really chilly.
Just kind of meant staying indoors quite a lot, but it was quite productive. We planted a tree, so our garden collection is starting to grow. So I'm very chuffed about that. That's a good thing, planting trees. And
what did it feel like to have a week off? Could you switch off?
Kind of. I'm sure everybody gets this, but you know, you've been working really hard, and then you have a week off, and then your body just goes, nah, it's all right. I'm not available for work now. So there's a lot of sitting around, a lot of naps, not very much to do. To get out to the garden and digging holes and things, that was really pushing the boat out.
Digging holes? What for?
The tree. You got to put the tree somewhere, yeah.
If a tree, you have to dig a hole.
Not sitting in a gutter somewhere.
Yeah. Alex.
Sorry.
The question is how long will it take us to kill it? Because that's the usual modus operandi for us and trees.
I think we've discussed plant care in a previous episode, and I think I admitted to killing a cactus. So please don't ask me for any advice.
I'm not going to be planting a cactus outside. That's not going to work.
How did the bee bar get on, Chris?
The bee bar. B-bar is a source
of
disappointment.
Did the B-bar die?
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether I just kind of lost patience with it, but I only had three little seedlings kind of crop up, and they were looking distinctly poorly. So we rescued them from the B-bar, and they're now sitting in nice, rich compost and finally looking like they're doing something. But the kind of the generous display of bee-friendly flowers is not to be. So, never mind. Sorry, listeners, if you're really hanging on the outcome of that one. There will be fewer bees in our garden this year. Thank you very much.
But in other news, Bee Bar is the great name for a pub.
It is.
The Bee Bar. Yeah.
You mean a pub at the bottom of the garden?
Yeah. I imagine them coming in with their top hats and sticks and ordering gin and tonics.
Sorry. Top hats and sticks.
Yeah, little walking sticks.
Like normal humans do in
little
bars
fancy
these
canes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right. It's been a long time since I've been in a pub, Chris. Well, I'm very happy because I got new running trainers yesterday.
Oh, you've been waiting ages for
I've
them.
Been waiting so long for these. I'd run
did
my
you get
old
fitted?
Ones. I did, had my gait analysis.
Look at you with your gait analysis.
It was like running on air. It was wonderful.
Well, the exciting thing that I bought today was a dangerous looking bottle of stuff to stop my pond from looking green.
Oh.
Excellent.
So now I very carefully have to read the instructions. Otherwise, the frog population might suffer.
I was going to say, it'll be frog spawn time soon, won't it, Kath?
They're here.
They're here.
They're definitely here. I've seen the little noses sticking up out of the water.
Excellent.
But it would help if the water wasn't green.
Well, we shall watch the space with the green
watch
pond.
Watch this space. I'll keep you updated.
I look forward to it. Shall we introduce this week's guest interview?
Go on.
All right, then. We are kicking off the Northern Guide to Happiness with a brilliant interview with Jack Lowe, who for the last 6 years has been travelling around the UK and the Republic of Ireland in a decommissioned ambulance darkroom called Nina, documenting every RNLI lifeboat station using glass plate photography. You're in for a treat this week. It's a really great interview. So enough of me talking. Here's Jack. Jack, a very warm welcome to the Northern Guide to Happiness. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm not too bad, all things considered.
Excellent.
Thank you, Alex.
Excellent. Good start. How's your day been today?
It's been good. It's been nice and gentle. To be honest, I've been building up to this conversation. You know, I've been purposefully getting myself in the right mindset and thinking about the things that do make me happy.
a well-prepared interviewee is always...
Yes, I've enjoyed start. Thinking about it.
Good, I'm glad. What have you enjoyed thinking about then?
Well, I think it's clear that there are many things that make us all happy. And I think lots of them for me, they just need a little bit of checking, you know? They need a little bit of bringing to the fore to make sure that you're essentially grateful for them. I think that's a word that keeps coming up for me, at least, when I'm talking about happiness, is gratitude. So, you know, I've really enjoyed thinking about what are those core things, because they're the most simple things usually that are right under your nose. I mean, some of them for me are really, really obvious, and we can talk about those, of course, and I hope we will talk about them. But there are other things, it's like, yeah, hang on a minute, what about that? And what about that?
Yeah. That,
what would you do without that exactly, you know?
Well, we shall delve into your list in a little while, but I thought perhaps maybe you could just introduce yourself, set the scene, just in case people listening, you know, haven't come across you and your work before. Can you just say a few words about yourself?
I don't know if I can just say a few words about myself, Alex. I think you know me well enough now to know that I'm prone...
A few more than a few words.
I'm prone to the verbose. I would describe myself these days as a documentarist, using photography, audio, film and words to make and share the Lifeboat Station project. And the Lifeboat Station project is a journey to every single RNLI lifeboat station in the UK and Republic of Ireland. And there's a twist in that I work as the Victorians used to. So I work from my mobile darkroom, making glass plate photographs of thousands of lifeboat volunteers around our shores. I'll leave that there for the moment as that short description. But that's really how I describe myself, because that is all consuming in my life. And it goes without saying also that I'm a family man, you know, so I'm a husband, a father, and creator.
So tell us about the Lifeboat Station project then, because we met probably at the very start of that journey, didn't we, to talk about the ideas that you had. And I've just sort of followed the journey of it, and it's just incredible what you've been up to. Can you tell people a bit more about it, and perhaps any particular happy moments that have come up as a result of taking part in that project?
Well, I'll try and do it without crying. Of course, you know, the last year or so has been, you know, another milestone on the journey, in that it's been paused. You know, the actual travelling side, the project bizarrely is getting stronger and stronger in terms of the core following. But yes, when we first met and started talking about it, I would love to be a fly on the wall on that conversation, because it'll be very different to the picture that's now evolved. You know, I can imagine that I would have been really scrabbling around, almost trying to work out how to make it happen, because I had this very, very clear vision to make this very simple idea come to fruition. But the idea was, it was clear that the idea was becoming so big, or that the idea was bigger than that, than the apparent simplicity of it. Because the idea is really simple. It's to simply visit, simply in inverted commas, to simply visit every single RNLI lifeboat station in the UK and the Republic of Ireland. So there are 238 of those in total, in the remotest corners of our shores. And when you start to delve more deeply into that as to how are you going to make that journey happen and how are you going to liaise with all the all of those lifeboat stations, you know, because the people are volunteers. Not, there are some full-timers as well, but not all lifeboat stations are manned. You know, they only are manned when the emergency pager sounds or if it's training night or something like that. So how am I going to liaise with those people? How am I going to arrange to meet them? How's it all going to work, especially with the old process that I'm using? You know, how am I going to get across my vision for this project? And that vision is something that has never disappeared. You know, it's only got stronger and stronger, and so is the passion. You know, something I'm often asked is, aren't you bored of it yet? No, I'm not, because what's clear, and I didn't describe it like this in the start because I had no idea what it meant, to be honest, but now I describe it as my life's work. Because at the start I was saying it'll take 3 to 5 years to make this project, and people were then saying, wow, 5 years, you know, they ignored the 3 year bit. But somebody reminded me recently that I used to say 2 to 3 years right at the start of it. To think now, how could I possibly ever dream of accomplishing that in 2 to 3 years? It just seems bizarre to think of that. So the 3 to 5 years, I can understand why I thought it might take 5 years. And here we are now, over six years later, and I've been to 150 lifeboat stations. You know, it's my full-time occupation. People again often ask me, what's your real job? It's like, well, this is it. This is my life. And so that means I'm about, I've forgotten the exact percentage, but it's around about 62, 63, 64%, something like that, of the journey. So I still have another 2.5 years to do, about 88 lifeboat stations to do. The magnitude of the project soon became apparent, you know, within the first few weeks. And then the more I went on in those early years, the more it became quite a battle, really, to make it all work. And the beauty of that really was that I had to think harder and harder and harder about how to make it work until I then started coming up with the answers that mean I'm still here today.
Do you, you might not be able to answer this, but do you have a favourite station?
No!
They're all my favourites.
Exactly. How could I have a favourite station? No. There are special things that happen at every single one. Every single station I've been to so far, so that's 150 lifeboat stations, which means 150 coastal locations, you know, places that I wouldn't necessarily have known existed or had any reason to go to had it not been for this very meticulous journey. Every station has there's something special that happens, and actually it's one of the things that certainly makes me happy is happenstance, which has almost got happy in the word, hasn't it?
What a great word, yeah.
You know, to go to these places and meet such incredible people who all share a core value, you know, there's a core ethos running through the whole network of all of these lifeboat stations, something that I also really cherish and have come to understanding in much greater detail, if you like. Special things happen at every station, and it could be as simple, again, you know, in inverted commas, as having just photographed one of the lifeboat crews and the pagers go off. And for those that don't know, by saying the pagers, I mean it's the emergency device that's attached to their belt or in their pocket or whatever, that's has a very distinct beep sound that they all respond to. And there's been more than one occasion now where the lifeboat crews have been kitted up because we've been making the photographs, so they've saved minutes on their normal launch time. My hair is standing up now thinking about it, you know. Because it really does give you goosebumps when you are starkly reminded why you're all there.
Yeah.
To see a boat launch in moments, and then, you know, there's one instance in Western Supermare on the Somerset coast when exactly this happened. The lifeboat launched, and I think that they'd saved 7 minutes on their normal launch time, something like that, to two children who found themselves in the water. One of them had kicked his football into the sea and thought he'd jump off the promenade into the high tide to get the ball. God. He's only 9 or 10 years old, something like that. The other child was a young girl who thought, I can swim, I can help him out. And she jumped in.
Oh my goodness.
Into a scenario where waves are crashing against a promenade, a concrete, you know, classic kind of curved concrete promenade that you're not going to climb out of unless you find some steps and can get out of it that way. And we could see them from where we'd just been making these photographs. There they were. The lifeboat was there, and I timed it. You know, I just had to stand aside, and just out of interest, I put the timer on. And within 8 minutes of the pagers sounding, the lifeboat crew were back ashore with the children running into the arms of their parents. And that, to have witnessed that on more than one occasion, that kind of scenario, is extraordinary, and something I would never have seen had I not started a journey like this.
It must have been quite a contrast for you, because you've kind of got that very sort of calm setup of getting the photograph ready, to just all of a sudden just being all, you know, all go, go, go. Just kind of seeing that quick transition.
Yes.
How did that feel?
Well, you know, there've been moments when it's calm and moments when it's stressful, you know, from my perspective, because actually the process that I use is very, very physical. And requires such high degrees of concentration all day long to make sure all your ducks are in a row with the process. You know, it really is a hands-on. Just to remind you, in the moments before making a photograph, I'm hand-making the photographic film on glass. You know, so I turn up with a box of chemicals and a box of glass, and once the camera's composed and I've got the image I want and the crew all waiting there but in position, I have to nip off to my mobile darkroom, Nina, as she's affectionately known, and hand make some photographic film right there in a few minutes, and then dash back to the camera and expose that glass plate, then dash back to the darkroom and develop it and fix it. So that is actually quite, in terms of my headspace, is quite a busy space, quite full on. In the times when the pages have gone off, when I'm in the midst of that, yes, I then have to just disarm that, because it's not about me in those moments, you know. It's about the lifeboat volunteers and the job they now have to do, and I just have to do my best. You know, I'm always thinking about that, actually, because whenever I park my vehicle, I have to be extremely careful. Wherever I leave, I never leave equipment in the way, you know, in such a way that it would impede the progress of the lifeboat if the pagers sound, if they're called to dash out to sea. But you know, there was another instance on the Isle of Wight at Yarmouth, one that I've recounted this many times over the years, because again, it really sticks in my mind. A really cold January morning, I got the crew all lined up just as I wanted them, and the pages sounded in their pockets, you know, while I composed the photograph. So I hadn't yet made the glass plate or anything, and again, they saved minutes on their launch time. And they fired up this, it's a 7-class lifeboat, so it's an enormous 42-ton, 3,500-horsepower vessel.
Wow.
Anybody who's heard me speak about the project before, they know that it's one of the things I adore about the RNLI.
Are you a bit of a geek when it comes to
I've been since I was a kid.
The machinery.
Yeah, since I was about 10 years old, I've been a lifeboat fanatic. And, you know, to hear the engines fire up and then off she goes. But they were back within an hour, having just saved the lives of two world-class dinghy sailors. One was 18 years old, one was 13 years old, in their capsized boat that they couldn't right in the middle of the Solent on a January winter's day. They transferred them to a helicopter. So in that time, a helicopter has deployed and hovered over the lifeboat and winched these kids up and taken them off to hospital. The lifeboat crew come back. And I think, oh, well, that's it then, you know, that'll be it for the day, really. And they said, right, where do you want us? Same place. So the glass...
Full of adrenaline, let's just go, let's just do it.
Yeah, so the glass plate we made is moments after they saved the lives. It went down as two lives saved of two teenage sailors. You know, and how can I get bored of that?
never a dull moment.
No, you know, those are some special moments, and there are all kinds of other special moments too, which are just much more normal human moments, you know, where you've been told a story about why somebody joined the lifeboats, or photographing a father and son, or a father and daughter who both volunteer on the lifeboats, or, you know, mother and daughter, or whole generations sometimes, you know, photograph multiple generations who are all volunteering on the lifeboat. Amazing happenstances.
And are you capturing those instances and stories as part of the photography project, as little stories? Because, you know, you've told that story there about the Isle of Wight, and nobody would know that backstory from looking at the photograph.
No.
So are you capturing that in a different way?
Well, I write blog posts, and my social media posts, you know, I always counted Instagram for a long time as my kind of journal. I don't post on Instagram now, but I still have access to the account, of course. And one of the things I do regret, it's not a regret, it's because actually, where would I find the energy from? I wish I had the energy to keep a journal, a handwritten journal. And I've got so many notebooks over the years that where I've had that energy, you know, had that burst of thought, must keep a journal of this. And what I've actually got is a stack of notebooks that have got about 2 pages started in them, you know.
Best intentions.
Yes, the pile of best intentions. That's what they are. So I have had to rely on my social media posts really as my journal. But what I'm doing now is putting more effort into my blog, making sure that those stories are conveyed into my blog posts. And really now the website, you know, it's so easy these days, isn't it, to say, go to the website, go to the website. But mine, I was tweeting about this the other day, that mine really is an environment, and it's actually the true archive of the work. Because yes, the glass plates are a real thing that exists, and they're bursting out of this studio here. You know, there are 150 boxes, one box from every single station around me here. But people can't just turn up here and look at glass plates. You know, the way they can see the images is on the website, and the audio recordings too, because I'm not just a photographer. People often just think about the glass plates and Jack Lowe's that guy with the old camera and the mobile darkroom. But I love making audio recordings too. Audio recordings are something that very much make that process makes me happy. You know, it's something I really, really enjoy. And the website is that living archive of the project. You know, there's so much to see on there, from the photographs themselves to the audio recordings, short films, all sorts of things.
So tell me about your social media, Jack, actually, now, because you've sort of touched on it a couple of times. And in our pre-recording chat, we kind of talked a little bit about, social media and happiness, and whether being on social media is good for your soul and mental health. What's your stance on that? Okay, is that your answer?
I think this is a huge can of worms.
I've opened it, so there you go.
Yes, yeah. So let's talk about it. Let's do it. I think there was a time when people really would have thought of me as being Mr. Instagram. I don't mean like the most handsome person on Instagram. Mr. Instagram. I would post at least once a day, maybe 3 times a day on Instagram, telling this story, particularly in the early days of the project. But I first started using Instagram, I've had 2 chapters on it. And I think it had been about 2012 when I first started using Instagram. And then they went through this whole thing with rights and all of that kind of thing. And loads of people deleted their accounts because they're saying, this is rubbish, we're off, we're photographers, you know. You know, so and once you've left, you can't have the same username again. So my Mr. Jack Lowe username disappeared. And then I decided that I did miss it after all. And then by that stage, my wife and my youngest son were on Instagram. And I thought, oh, you know, I'd really like to be back. And I couldn't have Mr. Jack Lowe. And Jack Lowe was already taken years, like years back, this notion came up that I should be Lord Low.
Why not?
So Lord Low is available. And even now, even though I haven't been posted on Facebook platforms for about a year, people actually still write to me or still call me Lord Low.
Lord Low.
Yeah. And
I prefer that to Mr. Instagram.
Yes, well, let's stick to Lord Low then. Why not?
That's how I shall refer to you now for the rest of the interview.
Thank you so much. So, thank you. It's about time. It's about time. Yes, show sure a little respect, please. what I'm driving at here is I've used it for a long time and made in that second chapter, I think it was approaching 4,000 posts. Put it this way, I gave it, given it a really good stab.
You know. Gave it a good go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. One of the products of lockdown and this period is just pausing for a moment, stopping for a moment and thinking, hang on a minute. All of this energy that I'm putting to all of these things, you know, I am exhausted, was a notion that I was already starting to feel before the Prime Minister announced that we needed to go into these lockdown measures. And that's probably the third or fourth distinct time out of the 5 or 6 year journey that I've really felt truly burnt out. You know, I was certainly reaching that stage again. And so I really started to look at the traffic platforms would actually send to my website, the engagement I was getting, whether that was going up or down. All, you know, I'm quite analytical. I like to look at these things and really understand these things. Because actually, although I do enjoy social media, it, for me, it has to have a product too, because I'm earning a living from this. This is, you know, this is how we keep a roof over our heads. Essentially, what it boiled down to for me was deciding what was vanity and what was efficient and truly engaging. And the more I looked into Instagram and thought about it, and Facebook as well, the more I felt I just need to move away from these platforms. And it wasn't just a self-preservation stance, it's also a moral stance too, because there are various other things that just didn't sit happily with me. And to my mind, having now progressed with this journey, didn't sit happily with the ethos of the project as I saw it, as I see it. So now the only social platform that I use is Twitter. I really enjoy the conversational nature of it and the brevity to a degree as well. And the fact that you can put links in posts. I know you can do that on Facebook, but you can't do that on Instagram other than via your profile, blah, blah, blah.
Yada, yada.
Yeah, yeah. We all know how these things work. Basically, the platforms were really draining me in terms of contentment and happiness and being able to function. I was feeling like I was being depleted at every level. And now I use methods that I feel enable me to have the conversation much more on my terms. So, for example, I really nurture my newsletter. That good old platform from the good old days.
Good old school. I love a good newsletter.
Yes, well, but who'd have thought that a newsletter would be considered old school? You know, an email newsletter. But it is, you know, in this era of where, you know, where 10 years is an eon. And I think one of the things that people forget is that creativity and projects happened way before the invention of Facebook. Facebook arrived in 2005, I think. How, you know, we can start to list all kinds of projects and famous works that happened way before social media. And the thing that you hear again and again, and I hear it now, of course, and people are disbelieving because I'm a photographer and you haven't got an Instagram feed. Why haven't you got an Instagram?
What's wrong with you?
Yes. And the answer usually is, you know, when you say to somebody, why should I have one then? It's like, well, it's what you do. It's what you have to do because it's what everyone else does. And that is worth paying attention to because that is not good enough. Because from a creator's point of view as well, if you think about that for a moment, if it's what everyone does, what you're being drawn into there is a conversation that isn't on your terms. It's on a homogenized platform that's presented how they want to present your information to keep you there and all your followers. You know, the aim isn't to let people go out of the platform. The aim is to keep people on the platform. And while my going down this route? Because it means it's a conversation that isn't actually on your terms. You know, you have this illusion that you're allowed to write what you want to write, which you can to a degree, but there's also heavy censorship on platforms like Facebook and Instagram. And I'm just not into that. I'm not into a conversation that isn't on my terms. There was a great quote, Jaron Lanier. He said in a TED Talk, "We cannot have a society in which if two people wish to communicate, the only way that can happen is if it's financed by a third person who wishes to manipulate them." Now, that's really worth bearing in mind as we are all darting about on these platforms. You know, and again, that classic thing, if it's free, you are the commodity. And people make complaints about newsletter platforms like MailChimp. You know, that's what I use for mine. They, oh, but you have to pay for it. It's like, yes, just pay for it. Because that means that you're getting your message across how you want to get your message across.
In your way.
In your way.
Yeah.
And the question I keep asking myself is, do I need to do any of it?
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, isn't that strange that we're moving to a position now where so many people are thinking, well, wouldn't that be nice if I didn't actually do that or didn't have to do that? Mm. That wasn't how it was pitched to us or set up in the first place. But it wasn't making me well, Alex. Mm. It wasn't making me feel better as a person. Quite the opposite in many ways. You know, for the classic reasons that we hear about often on the news, you know, feel like you were never good enough.
You used the word contentment. Before you kind of said that it was kind of draining your contentment levels. Is that one way that you gauge your happiness levels, is through your level of contentment?
Yes, because happiness is a very tricky word for me in itself. I strive for level contentment.
Level contentment
is the way I
like that.
That's the way I see it, because happiness is often unattainable for many people. You know, there's the notion of happiness. So I don't mean to say that in a program that's called A Guide to Happiness. breaking news. I put it this way: I find happiness is very closely linked to the opposite, to depression, and to feeling very, very down generally. You know, when I'm even being careful using the word depression, because people, it gets attached kind of clinically, doesn't it, and to diagnoses, and you it's all right, we can put a label on that, you're depressed. So let's just stick to feelings of feeling down or feeling up. And happiness for me is too closely linked to the feelings of being down. You know, if I'm happy, I would actually probably class that as mania. I'm feeling maniacal and probably doing in the heads of everybody around me. Because I'll be stotting off walls, you know? So I strive for level contentment, because I think when I'm just calm and everything's on a pretty even keel, you know, again, that phrase, even keel, that's a good way of describing how I like to be as well. Not too much up here, not too much down there, but just, you know, and trying to even out the peaks and troughs wherever possible. And I really feel like I'm generally getting there. It's been quite hard lately, I have to say, because there's been something about this third lockdown that's, I think, worn out a lot of people. And I put myself in that bracket as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And I've really struggled with my level contentment. But, you know, I was really pleased yesterday to go out in my kayak for the first time. That's a great thing that helps me to achieve the heady heights of level contentment. So I was out on the Tyne for the first time, because now that the stay at home restriction or guideline has been lifted. And again, I've been liaising with the RNLI just to make sure that, you know, in my line of work, that it's okay to go back on the water. I mean, people haven't appreciated that they've been going to sea on boats and kayaks and whatnot, but actually it's not been deemed safe to do so, because you're adding an extra layer of jeopardy to anybody who might potentially rescue you. And people say, you know, what's, oh yeah, but Jack, I never run into trouble, like,
yeah, blah blah blah, it won't happen to me. Yeah,
but whoever goes to sea planning to get into trouble, you know, you don't book the RNLI before you get on the water. Do you mind just meeting me in about 45 minutes or so? I think I'll be about a mile offshore.
I'll be in some jeopardy.
Yeah, I'll be in some jeopardy. So maybe see you there, okay? You know, it doesn't work like that. And actually, I've just edited an audio recording that I've made in 2016 of a mechanic that I interviewed on Orkney. And he had a very simple line along those lines, which was, nobody makes an appointment for us. That explains in just a few words that sentiment of, you know, nobody ever plans to run nobody ever plans to get into trouble at sea or anywhere. And anyway, it is finally okay to go locally on the Tyne, because that's my local kayaking option. Ordinarily, I might be out at sea on my travels, I often go down to Seaham and paddle with some friends out of Seaham Harbour. But that just hasn't been possible for months now. And I was out on the river and just, shall we say, regathering my fitness. I didn't know if I'd get up as far as the bridges, because it seems very close, doesn't it? But I launch at St. Peter's Marina. I have an arrangement with them where I can launch in St. Peter's Marina there. But it's a good 25 minute paddle to get to the Millennium Bridge. And I was kind of gradually hopping my way up. I stopped off in the mouth of the Usburn
to catch your breath.
Yeah, to catch my breath and, you know, wait for the wind to calm down, you know, that kind of thing. And I thought that would be, to be honest, that's all I thought I'd do yesterday, was just do that. But I ploughed on. And got up as far as the Tyne Bridge, and somebody called out to me, "That'll keep you fit." And I looked over, and it is just this lovely guy, you know, flat cap Geordie, and his mate. They were just chuckling at me, because I think they're just really enjoying the sight of seeing a sea kayaker, because it's a lovely boat. It's an 18-foot long kayak, and I think it's always quite a sight to see it on the river. You know, at least I hope people would like to see it. You know, there are a few more sublime sights than seeing a sea kayaker in full stride. You know, you look like the ultimate mariner. Well, that's how I picture myself anyway. and it's just this lovely exchange. And I realise that's one of the things I've really missed in all of this. Is going back to happenstance again, you know, going back to those lovely social interactions that just spring out of nowhere. And there are these two lovely guys on the quayside chatting to me on the river. And he said, you know, where are you off to? I said, the tide's just turning now. And he nodded, because like he knew what the tide was doing. And I think he liked that I knew what the tide was doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to go up onto the bridge here, turn around and go back. And sure enough, did exactly that. And then on the way back down, waved at them again, you know, from the water. And that, to me, is the antithesis of social media. You know, that's where life happens, is by living life. And that's why, really, although I do know that I'll be missing out on conversations between my family and other loved ones online, I know that I can still have those conversations elsewhere. As I say, via texts or calls like this. And I don't know, I think we've lost a lot of sight of that somehow. So yes, that was that's a lovely happy happenstance that happened just yesterday. Happy happenstance is happening.
What else then helps you maintain that sort of level contentment then?
Well, one of the things I've written down, because when I was trying to think
on your list,
on my list, I've written a list of things that make me levelly content.
That's it. We're just going to rebrand the podcast. Yes.
The Geordie Guide to Level Contentment. It actually sounds pretty good. You're welcome.
Bit of a tongue twister.
Yes. A core thing is health. That if I was just asked what makes you happy, I might have listed, kayaking, making photographs, audio, family. But health. I know that when I feel healthy and can move around and go kayaking, for example.
Regathering your fitness.
Regathering my fitness. You know, that is fundamental to my being. If I have been cooped up all day long, and maybe not eating as well as I could do, or whatever, that I've noticed now how that really does drain you. And actually, in normal life, in the old normal, you know, when people talk about returning to normal, we hear those discussions a lot. I think there'll be a new normal coming up at some stage. But if we think about life BC, before Corona, that I think there's so many distractions in a busy life that possibly mask when you're not eating so well or not looking after yourself so much, that you get carried along by events and you forget about all that. But because everything's been really taken down to bare basics lately, it's highlighted for me that I value my health more than ever. And particularly when we've seen the context of why life has changed, and we've seen people taken far too early from the planet and from their loved ones, it's made me appreciate that side a lot more. Made me really realise that should be added to the list too, as a core thing that helps me be happy, is to be in good health.
And I think it's something that we take for granted as well until we don't have it. You know, even if it's just getting a really bad, you know, cold, if you haven't been ill for a long time, you kind of forget what it's like to feel well, don't you? Until it's sort of taken away from you.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I had a bit of insight into that over the last year, because as it transpires, this has worked out well for me in a way, because I was very ill with Epstein-Barr virus winter before last, so 2019 to 2020. We all were in the house, the three of us. It used to be four of us in the house, but our elder son now lives in New Zealand. So he's living his best life over there.
Oh, he's in the best place.
He is. And we didn't realise what we had at the time, but all we knew was that we were laid out for, it was a good 6, 7, 8 weeks.
Wow.
Really hit hard. This is before the language of coronavirus came about. And so then we thought, you know, we were in that camp of people who maybe thought we'd had it before COVID supposedly arrived in the UK. We thought, oh, maybe we have had it, because it's so severe, the illness, and we were so wiped out. Anyway, it cleared away in early February, and I then started resuming normal life. But something I was acutely aware of, apart from these periods of mania, of overactivity, of happiness, as you might say, you know, of like being a bit kind of too up here, was that I was absolutely worn out. And it got to the point where I had to really lower my expectations of what I was able to do each day, to the point where I just decided, if I can just do one thing today, if I can just achieve one thing, then that's good enough. You know, I'm going to release this notion of being ashamed that I can't just keep going like a machine, like I have done for years in all of my working life. And then I reached a crux, because I did a bucket list thing in August. I kayaked to the Farne Islands with a guide. So there were three of us out there on the water. And that was a phenomenal experience. But afterwards, I was absolutely shattered. I couldn't function for about a good 4 or 5 days, something like that afterwards. And then in terms of traveling, the only time I've traveled with the project was in September. I went to paste up a giant poster of one of my photographs at a location in North Norfolk. Cut a long story short with that, I came back and I was absolutely finished for about 2 weeks. You know, lying on the sofa, just unable to really do anything. And you know, that has been a long drive, and then the 3 or 4 intense days of pasting up this huge poster. And between the Farne Islands and that, it became clear that we needed to get to the root of this. What was it? Because something was wrong. And so I had a blood test, and then got the results back when I came back from pasting that poster. And it transpired then that all the pennies dropped into place, because it's quite an extensive medical that I managed to persuade my GP to do, and they agreed that something was wrong. And they then realised that illness that we'd all had was Epstein-Barr virus. And what I was suffering from was post-viral chronic fatigue.
Mm.
So the same thing that's described as long COVID. Now, if you if you've had a this heavy viral load, whether it's COVID or Epstein-Barr, it's two very different conditions. It's quite likely that you will suffer some kind of fatigue afterwards while your body recovers. And they told me it'd be a year for me to fully recover. So looking at February 2021, so the February just gone, I was like, really? What, another few months of this? And that's exactly what happened. And suddenly, towards the end of January, start of February of this year, so right on time, if you like, everything started to lift. This veil felt like it was lifting from me. And again, my point being here that I have had an insight into what it is to have your health removed, to be incapacitated. And I'll have a newfound empathy for anybody who I hear is suffering from chronic fatigue, because I've heard comments like this too, that, well, you're just a bit tired. Can't you just like have a bit of a sleep? It's like, no, it feels like there's like a cloak over your whole body consuming your every fiber. It's utterly debilitating. You can't actually function. So that's why health is on my list right up there at the top, because it feels like from that point, I don't mean to kind of prioritize the things on the list, but without your health, everything stems from that point, really. Your own personal conditioning.
Absolutely, yeah. I was going to say, it has to be up there.
Yeah, and we're talking about
to be able to appreciate and enjoy the rest of it.
Yes, yeah. And I mean to incorporate mental well-being into that as well. You know, all of the things. And I'm glad that the conversation is really happening about mental well-being and general self-preservation, and that it's being thought of as being up there with an injury or like a broken arm or something. You know, it's like a real thing. Just because it's invisible and you can't see it because it's hidden in your brain box, it doesn't mean it's not real. And that, you know, I feel much more acutely aware and thankfully in tune with all that now. And not being on Facebook and Instagram has really helped me become much more healthy in my head. That's the crux of it.
So health is at the top. What else is on the list?
Family, people. So family and loved ones. I really love more than ever. I don't know if it's just a simple facet of getting older that you appreciate these things more. But to see our children growing up and to see Callum, our eldest boy, is now in, as I mentioned earlier, in New Zealand. You know, I felt very happy vicariously because he showed us the view from his flat in Nelson in New Zealand, living essentially a restriction-free life. I felt very happy for him that he was able to do that. You know, I felt it gave me a boost, gave us a boost to realize that that's still attainable, because it can feel a bit unattainable at times at the moment, can't it? But it is.
Absolutely.
But it is there. Yeah. Still, it is possible. And I really enjoyed listening to your conversation with Dan Jackson as well, and I loved hearing him clear up the word crack.
Yes, that caused a lot of debate on Twitter, actually.
Oh, did it? I missed that. Because I'm one of those people who always writes craic. So I've written down here crack, because
crack. Good crack.
Yeah. there are fewer things more beautiful in life than good crack. You know, to meet somebody at the pub or to just have some banter with an old friend as you're walking along the street, or you know, just those simple things. And the instance I mentioned, kayaking, you know,
on the river. Yeah. Yeah.
Just somebody feeling that they can just reach out and say, that'll keep you fit, and then have a little chat about what you're doing and when you're going back. And, you know, and Newcastle is amazing for that. And I loved hearing Dan's explanation of that and his theories behind that. You know, Newcastle does seem a particularly special place for that. And then stemming from that is community. Community is right up there high on my list. I bang on about it all the time on Twitter, and anyone who will listen or not listen. Because I believe that community spirit will get us through this. And I still feel there's not enough of it. I feel like we're not learning enough about from this, you know. I read a great blog post by Kate Marvel, Dr. Kate Marvel, explaining her faith in individuals. She knows that there are good people. You know, I feel like I'm doing my best. I'm sure you feel like you're doing your best. I'm sure many of your listeners feel like they're doing the best and being the best that they can be. But she, I felt, was helping to explain usefully that she didn't have faith in the collective. And I know that sounds quite downbeat, perhaps, but actually I think it helps deal with the emotions. You know, a classic case lately has been the litter after the sun's been out, the litter in Heaton Park, the litter in Hyde Park, Nottingham, Sheffield, all these things are on the news. Most people just could not understand what that mentality was. And that was a lack of community-mindedness. And if you are angry about it, that's good, because it means that you are noticing these things and that you are more community-spirited than the people who left all that litter. But at the time, I said on Twitter, right, I'm done with this. I'm not going to grieve over these pictures of litter. I'm going to Heaton Park right now to help clear up. And that's what I did. As it happened, I was a little bit slow off the mark because...
It's already been done.
Yeah, but because the little army of people who've been out there since quarter to nine in the morning doing it, was walking out of the gates. And I was like, oh, I feel like that scene in Gladiator. You know when Joaquin Phoenix, what's his character? Commodus, turns up to the battle, you know, where there's bloodshed everywhere. and he's meeting his father, says, oh, father, am I too late for the battle? And he says, you're too late for the war. He says, I'll sacrifice 1,000 goats. He said, keep your goats. I'll sacrifice 1,000 goats.
The sentiment was there.
Exactly. So instead I went to Warwick Street Stadium and picked up a litter there and said, you know, it's all there. And then turned up the next morning and did it there. You know, like, get mad, yes, but get active as well. You know, don't be just somebody who just sits there getting mad at everyone else. You can make a difference. And by doing that, you're leading by example and enlightening people. And I think that's just as vital and intrinsic to community spirit and displaying community spirit, you know. And that's right up there on my list for me as well, because I feel that is what will truly get us through this. If we are all more considerate to each other, it feels like it's one of those messages that might just... people might just mentally switch off when they hear that kind of thing. But tying it back to the lifeboats, you know, that's 5,000 volunteers around our coastline who will drop everything at a moment's notice to go and save somebody they don't know at sea. That's what I'm talking about. That kind of ethos.
Completely selfless, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Self. Yes, serve not self. You know, that... like, what can I do for those around me? And the... and once you start exploring that and start doing the do, the enrichment you get from that is fantastic in itself. So those are the highest things on my list, really, are health, family, people, love, you know, loved ones, crack, community. Mm-hmm. And actually, as I reel those off there, I think, yes, gosh, that's, it feels complete somehow. It feels whole, you know, wholehearted living. That is thinking about those around us more than we think about ourselves. And that would sort out so much of this stuff. You know, I don't mean to get political about it, but the way the country's run even, you know, it'd sort out all of those issues if there's more concern, genuine concern for the well-being of others.
Well, I think that's possibly a perfect note to end on.
But we've only been speaking for 5 minutes. What about the other 10 hours?
I think you'll find an hour and 5 minutes.
What about the other 10 hours?
I've got to edit this, man.
Spare a thought. Yeah, speaking of community minded,
spare
Jack.
Spare a thought. Spare a thought for the editors.
Yes. Yeah, sorry, I was being totally selfish there. Think about my own wafty needs.
You've spoken about the Lifeboat Station project, of course, your website. Is there anything you would like to kind of give a shout out to as we kind of come to the end of the interview?
Well, another thing on my list is the greatness of others. I love the greatness of others. And so if you would like to see a good news story about the greatness of others, I hope it's not too shameless to say, do have a look at my website. And I think that's the shout out that I'd like to give is a shout out to the greatness of others. And for us just to remember that as a breed, we get a lot wrong, but there are an awful lot of people out there who are getting a lot right. And each of us can choose to be one of those people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jack. On that note, I'll say goodbye.
Thank you very much, Alex. Thank you for
thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So that was Jack. What did people think?
Well, that was a doozy. That was a brilliant interview. Just...
What did you enjoy
about
it? I
loved listening to it. It was just... He's obviously a lovely guy. He's got loads of really interesting experiences and things to talk about and passions. And you know when somebody talks about their passion and it just sort of exudes out of it. But yeah, I'll take a step back for a second because I know Kath's got something she wants to say about it.
Once again, I'll lower the tone of the conversation.
Oh, great.
Once more. Into the ditch, my friend.
I'll take it from the intellectual level of Chris. But I was fascinated by the kayaking up the Tyne. Mm-hmm. And I shall store this useful fact that it takes 25 minutes in an 18-foot kayak to get from St. Peter's Basin to the Millennium Bridge.
There you are.
And I just thought I will always have this mental image of him in the kayak going up to the Millennium Bridge. So I just was blown away by that, absolutely.
He filmed it, so it's on his Twitter feed. Oh, cool. If you want to go and have a look at it. He kind of had a camera at the end of the kayak and filmed part of the journey. So if you want to go and have a look.
Is his chat with the guy on the video?
Yeah. You can't quite hear the guy on the footpath, but you can hear the conversation, yeah. I just love... I mean, he came up with at least two phrases that can quite easily be put on a T-shirt. And regathering my fitness will... I will never forget that phrase. Such a brilliant phrase. What about you, Chris? What did you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, the kayaking image just kind of really made it for me. Particularly, we bought ourselves an inflatable kayak. Formerly known as an inflatable dinghy. I'm not sure when they became inflatable kayaks, but last year, which we've done up and we've sort of gone up and down on the River Till up in Northumberland. But yeah, doing it on the River Tyne, that probably take a bit more courage. You'd have to get the tides right, wouldn't you? Yeah,
otherwise, definitely.
You're not going anywhere. Just loads of paddling and just kind of remaining stationary. That would be funny, wouldn't it? There was loads of stuff which really kind of tickled me about what he was saying. This kind of image of him talking about, you know, people that are happy all the time, you just feel a little bit suspicious of them. You know, it's like a form of mania, which I think it was what he said, which just kind of made me really giggle when he was talking about it. But there was loads of kind of stuff which resonated as well. He was talking about his post-viral fatigue and kind of changing his expectations about, you know, what he was able for that year to achieve and just kind of resetting things a little bit. And I can relate to that a lot because I've had chronic fatigue since about 2016, 2017.
I thought of you when he started talking about that. I thought, oh, Chris will be able to relate to
but,
this.
You know, but it's a really hopeful thing. Here's a man who drives a disused ambulance all around the country taking glass plate photographs of things, you know, after being ill. You know, he can do it. Surely I'll be able to do it. That's all good. The other thing which interested me was him talking about digital platforms and Twitter and all that stuff and how, mm-hmm. you know, how he's mm-hmm. kind of consciously made a decision about this stuff isn't bringing me that contentment. It's actually taking up a lot of energy. And, you know, that's a difficult one because I'm sure that there will be plenty of people listening to this that over the last year in particular, you know, social media has been a real lifeline, being able to contact people that have been out of reach physically. But what he says is right. You know, there's a lot of stuff which happens on these social media spaces that when you actually sit down and think about this, you know, is this actually helping me? So that was one thing that I gave up for Lent Not. I didn't give up Twitter for Lent. I gave up checking Twitter first thing in the morning because I realised all that would happen is I was open up Twitter and have a look on the iPad before I'd actually got up and have my coffee. And within about 10 minutes, I'd be cross about something. So like, no, that's enough of that. No more. So yeah.
It was the idea of empowerment, I think, or disempowerment.
Mm. And taking control.
Yes, taking control of your conversation, and that really struck me very strongly. That you drift into it.
Yeah, it was quite wise words.
And that's insidious.
Yeah, and having conversations, it's not just conversations between the two of you. It's conversations between the two of you that are being observed and, you know, are reliant on somebody else's platform. So now that we're in a position where, you know, finally we can sort of get out and see people a little bit more easily, you know, that's, I'm sure people will be looking forward to getting that. There's no real replacement for it, is there?
Yeah. And I should probably say part of the interview that I cut out was us talking about me wanting to leave Facebook and not feeling that I could. And I just want to let Jack know that I have deleted the Facebook app off my phone. And I'm on to sort of day two. I'm doing all right. I'm surviving. So we'll see how long that lasts. Thanks.
That's to check in next week to find out how Alex is doing.
I really enjoyed the part of the interview when he was talking about the litter and cleaning up Eaton Park and this idea of if you're annoyed about something, then do something about it. And that's true community. Yeah. Yes. And now he had to go and look for another place to tidy up because somebody had got there before him.
That was his 200 goats from the gladiator analogy, wasn't it? Going to the stadium.
Oh, one of my favourite films.
There's something going on at the moment. I think but there's a campaign now for beach tidy up over the next year, and that's something I think I'd quite like to go out and do. You know, clean the dunes, and you know we've talked about the coast so much in these podcasts.
We really have, yes.
It would be good to kind of give something back to that.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Jack, for a wonderful start to our new podcast. So thank you. If you've been inspired by this podcast episode, then we would love to hear from you. We would love to hear your stories and opinions on what happiness means to you. You can get in touch via email, hello@thenorthernguidetohappiness.co.uk, or you can find us on Twitter @NorthHappiness and Instagram and Facebook @NorthernHappiness. Next week, we have another great episode with Robin Fry, who is CEO of North Tyneside Voda, which is the voluntary organisations development agency for North Tyneside. Amongst many things, we talk about Voda's response to the COVID pandemic and his love of filmmaking and music making. So you'll hear me ask him questions like this. I mean, you've been working with North Tyneside communities for years. How have they been seeking happiness, as you say, over the last 12 months? And hear him give answers like this.
What an interesting question. I think for some people it's been a matter of survival initially, but it's interesting to see how, in my limited exposure to this, how actually with some people, once they were reassured that they were going to get their most, and we're talking about the most basic needs met in terms of food, shelter, heating, I think we saw a bit of a shift. So there's a couple of people that I'll always remember, and I learned so much from the experience that in the early days, people could be quite rude to us on the phone. We were going to deliver a food parcel and they were phoning saying, why on earth haven't I got food? This is ridiculous. And this was quite a new thing for us. We're not used to coming up against that kind of attitude. And at first we were like, what a bloody nerve, you know, we're offering free food and we've got all these volunteers and all people are doing is complaining. But I think, you know, it pretty soon became apparent that these were people absolutely terrified of how's their wife going to get a medication? How are they going to feed their family? And I think as soon as we could start empathising and putting ourselves in other people's positions, it became quite obvious why people were up a height. There was that real confusion, that real not knowing what was coming next. And often once people got the food, their attitude completely changed, and then you could start to have those kind of conversations.
So, we've reached the end of our very first episode of the Northern Guides to Happiness. We hope you've enjoyed listening, and take care, and see you all again next week for another episode.